From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Taking Up the Serpent, we talk with writer Dennis Covington about the religious practice of snake handling. His new book, Salvation on Sand Mountain, is about one Southern Appalachian church's snake handling rituals. After reporting on the church, Covington was moved to handle snakes himself. Also, we meet actress Vanessa Redgrave. She has a new autobiography. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Paperboy, a new novel by Pete Dexter, who also wrote Paris Trout. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Mexican stock market has stabilized somewhat. Prices had fallen more than 11% at one point today, but they're now reversing the trend. Analysts say investors still don't have faith in economic projections released by the Mexican government. The historian that House Speaker Newt Gingrich hired last week and then fired last night says charges against her are slanderous and outrageous. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
In a letter released today, Christina Jeffery wrote, "I seem to have been fired in the press." She continued, "I frankly do not know what my status is now." In a letter dated 9:15 p.m. last night, Speaker Gingrich left little doubt about Jeffery's status, saying, quote, "I do not feel that it would be prudent nor beneficial for you or your family or the House of Representatives to continue your employment at this time." Gingrich dismissed Jeffery after reports surfaced that in 1986 she recommended against federal funding for a high school curriculum on the Holocaust because, quote, "it gives no evidence of balance or objectivity. The Nazi point of view," she wrote, "however unpopular, is still a point of view and is not presented, nor is that of the Ku Klux Klan." Critics of Gingrich for hiring Jeffery in the first place praised the speaker today for acting quickly to let her go. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
The man accused of injuring 4 dozen riders on a New York City subway car has pleaded not guilty to attempted murder and other charges. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC reports.
49-year-old Edward Leary entered his plea from a hospital bed where he's being treated for serious burns suffered in the December 21st incident on board a lower Manhattan subway. Prior to the hearing, Leary received morphine to help with pain. Reporters were barred from the hospital arraignment, but Leary's defense attorney, Stephen Murphy, said his client pleaded not guilty to attempted murder, assault, and attempted grand larceny. He says additional charges are expected in a superseding indictment. Authorities say Leary was planning a series of firebombings to extort money from city transit officials. Investigators found threatening notes in Leary's Scotch Plains, New Jersey home. Defense attorney Murphy says the notes were outlines for an unpublished science fiction book, not a blueprint for an underground extortion scheme against the city. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
Passengers were able to fly in and out of Newark International Airport again. It was closed yesterday after a main power outage. Airlines are still juggling schedules because planes that should have been at the New Jersey airport aren't there. The power was lost after a worker accidentally cut through 3 power cables yesterday. The government says wholesale prices rose 1.7% last year, and the Labor Department says the producer price index was up 0.2% in December. The Federal Reserve will be watching prices closely in 1995. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up almost 5 points, 3,865. This is NPR. The United States is meeting Russia to talk about the Chechen war. Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot is in Belgium meeting the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister. They're being joined by ministers from Eastern and Central European countries. Talbot is on a 2-day mission to promote a peaceful solution to the conflict. He is also setting up a meeting next week between Secretary of State Warren Christopher and Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozarev. A consumer watchdog group is warning passage of the Republican contract with America would result in severe cuts in programs that benefit older Americans, veterans, and college students. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
Families USA says if Congress passes a balanced budget amendment and tax cuts for families making more than $100,000 a year, then cuts of at least 22% would be needed in Medicare, veterans benefits, and student loans. Arthur Fleming, health secretary during the Eisenhower administration, says Medicare cuts of that magnitude would violate existing contracts with the American people.
To me, it's unthinkable that this nation, having started down the road of Medicare, would turn back and break faith with the people who are dependent on Medicare.
In coming up with its numbers, Families USA assumes that Social Security and defense spending would be off the table. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
A published report says Colombian drug smugglers are using old passenger planes to fly cocaine to Mexico. The New York Times says smugglers buy old Boeing 727s and refit them. American and Mexican officials say the planes fly at night with their lights off. They also use fake identification numbers and turn off radar that tells air traffic controllers where they are. The Times reports once the drug is in Mexico, it's trucked into the U.S. It's estimated the planes can carry 6 tons or more of the drug. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dennis Covington, was introduced to a sect of snake-handling Christians in Scottsboro, Alabama, 3 years ago. He was writing an article for the New York Times about a snake-handling preacher who was convicted of attempting to murder his wife with rattlesnakes. Covington grew up in a Methodist church in Birmingham, but after his brief encounter with snake handlers, he wanted to learn more. Following the trial, he made repeated visits to snake-handling churches. Eventually, he was moved to take up serpents himself. He left the snake handlers at the end of 93, recognizing that he couldn't really be one of them after all. He refused to be a witness to suicide, particularly his own. His new book, Salvation on Sand Mountain, Snake Handling and Redemption in Southern Appalachia, is part journalism, part memoir. Let's start with a reading about a service. At the front of the church stands Charles McLaughlin, who is about to hand a 4'4" black timber rattlesnake to his wife Eileen.
The rattlesnake was so big, Charles could hardly get a hand around it. He would later tell me that the Lord spoke to him in that moment and asked him, "Who do you love more, me or your wife?" Charles said the answer was God, and so he decided to go ahead and give her the snake. It was a moment that suggested that most ancient of stories, a garden, a serpent, a man and his wife. But now the story seemed oddly reversed, as though by giving his wife the serpent, the man could restore the communion with God that had been broken. Eileen's hands, which had been stretched upward, now suddenly turned to receive. But as Charles began to hand the rattlesnake to her, it rolled. He steadied it. It rolled again, doing a full turn in his hands, as though it were on a lathe. Charles stepped back and handed the serpent to Carl Porter, who prayed over it aloud before he stepped forward and lay it into Eileen's hands. Her face changed. It seemed to open out. The sound that she made did not resemble human speech. "Have your way, Lord," someone said, as Eileen trembled in ecstasy with the big black rattlesnake outstretched in her hands. I was only an observer, but I felt I had been drawn into something so painfully intimate that I was morally obliged to look away even as I stared the harder. I wanted to step in and rescue Eileen. But from what? Wasn't it the same thing that was happening to me?
What kind of looks did people have on their faces during the process of snake handling?
You would expect that in the midst of religious ecstasy that there would be this expression of enormous joy. But for me, anyway, the expression seemed to be one of exquisite pain, as though something were being taken away violently from the person. I see that now, having experienced it. I see what that is, of course, because you are losing something in the midst of religious ecstasy. What you're losing is yourself, that sense of yourself. And, you know, Jesus tells us in the scripture that in order to find yourself, you must first lose yourself. Of course, that's a paraphrase. It's a paradox.
You don't think what people were experiencing and what you were seeing on their faces was fear?
No. I don't think so.
What is it about this handling of snakes?
It's a mystery. And the longer I hung around the snake handlers, the deeper the mystery became for me. I understand why they do it on the surface, and that is to confirm the word. In Mark 16, the risen Christ tells his disciples that believers in him will take up serpents. And so the handlers today in the southern United States are confirming this fact. Yes, we are the believers who are taking up serpents. The scripture is true. But I think beneath that rather superficial explanation, there are layers of motivation. And I found that I could only explore those by becoming a part of the phenomenon. And so many of the questions I had started out asking about the handlers, I ultimately had to ask about myself.
What kinds of questions?
Why would I take up a serpent? To what larger end? What was the meaning of it? What was the purpose? The question of how one does it is rather elementary in retrospect. One simply takes it. You know, there's no trick, there's no secret. The snakes haven't been defanged, they haven't been anesthetized in any way. They're lively and alert, healthy specimens, some of them newly caught, who can deliver a very painful and, in some cases, lethal bite.
Well, how often do snake handlers actually get bit?
Often. Most of the handlers that I dealt with in the past 2 years, at some point during those 2 years, were bitten. None of them died, but some of them came very close.
The poison isn't enough to kill you?
Well, the severity of the bite depends upon a lot of circumstances. The venom of canebrake rattlesnakes can be lethal to man, to adults. It isn't always lethal. And, of course, a lot depends on whether the victim of the bite receives medical attention. Most of the people in these snake handling churches, when they're bit, don't go to the doctor, but occasionally they do.
When somebody, you know, handles a snake at a religious service, is their fate seen to be a message from Jesus Christ? In other words, if the snake doesn't bite, does that mean you're in God's favor? And if the serpent does bite you, is that a comment on how you are perceived in God's mind?
Well, within the snake handling community, there are different ideas about this. But I think that the predominant idea among those handlers that I was with is that there's no guarantee of any protection. The scripture simply says that believers in my name, believers shall take up serpents. It doesn't say that believers won't be bitten or that believers won't die as a result. There are some handlers in Kentucky who believe in what's called a perfect anointing, in which once anointed by the Spirit to take up a serpent, the worshiper is protected from harm. But that is, I think, a minority position.
Some people, when they hear about snake handling, just dismiss it as some, you know, wacky cult that where people believe bizarre things and do bizarre things. You didn't dismiss it at all. I mean, it really spoke to you. You were drawn to it. Tell me more about what drew you.
I think, in all honesty, I must tell you that I've always been kind of drawn to danger as a journalist, or not so much to danger as to that illusion of danger, that veneer of danger. There's also, for me personally at the time, there was a need, a longing to experience ecstatic religious worship. I don't know, you know, that was just a particular place that I was in my own spiritual journey. And finally, I had this sort of predictable middle-age urge to find out who my people were, where I came from. I didn't know much about my extended family, my ancestors. And in ways, I discovered that the snake handlers and I are connected by blood. I mean,
well, the snake handling congregations are usually rural. You're from the city, from Birmingham. What blood connection did you find?
Well, I found that my people had, we hadn't always lived in the city, of course, and that we had too had come down from the mountains in much the same way that the handlers had. The snake handling didn't originate way back in the hills somewhere, as most of us probably think. It originated when the hill people came down from the mountains and first encountered contemporary American culture. So it's sort of a reaction to that, a shock to suddenly being confronted with a culture that has, in some ways, lost a sense of the sacred.
So when does this start? In the, like, about the turn of the century?
It started around 1910 in East Tennessee, and also sprang up independently of that on Sand Mountain, Alabama, around 1912.
So did you find anybody in your family who actually handled snakes?
Well, I came close. I found a family of snake-handling Covingtons who had come to Alabama about the same time my family did and settled about 40 miles away. The snake-handling Covingtons settled on the north bank of the Tennessee River in North Alabama, and the other Covingtons, my Covington, settled on the south bank of that same river. I wasn't able to establish the link. I don't know whether we were related, but I think we were related in, you know, if not in a physical sense, certainly in a geographical sense and in a spiritual sense. I think there was some connection there.
My guest is Dennis Covington, author of the new book Salvation on Sand Mountain, Snake Handling and Redemption in Southern Appalachia. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dennis Covington, and he's the author of the new book, Salvation on Sand Mountain, about congregations of snake handlers in the South. Now, how many times did you actually handle snakes yourself?
I handled on three different occasions, a total of four snakes. They were all rattlesnakes. I did not handle for prolonged periods of time, and I don't intend to handle again.
What moved you the first time that you did it? Did you go to the congregation that day saying, today's the day and I'm preparing myself, I'm going to do it today?
No, I didn't. But I did ask in prayer that I be given this sign. And that's what happened. I mean, and I know that sounds very sort of Pollyannish maybe, but I do believe that our prayers are answered and that when we ask things in the name of Jesus that we are given them, and that's essentially what happened. That's not something I talk a lot about in the book because I think that kind of talk in ways sort of goes past the general reader. If you understand what I mean.
Mm-hmm. So you asked for a sign. Were you given one?
Yes.
Could you talk about what it was?
Well, I was given an anointing by the Holy Spirit that permitted me to take up a rattlesnake. It's hard to describe exactly what that's like, except that I can tell you that it is an extraordinarily intense and in ways beautiful experience. It's like nothing else that's ever happened to me. The sign, that I was under an anointing was the absolute disappearance of fear.
Had you experienced that before, like when you were covering the war in El Salvador?
It's very similar. It was very similar to an adrenaline high that I experienced under fire in El Salvador. A sense of extraordinary well-being and happiness, despite the fact that you were facing imminent death.
So once that feeling came over you, you approached the front of the church where the snakes were?
Right.
And do you have to say something to let the preacher know that you're ready?
No. No, the preacher knows. Everything's very clear.
So what happened right after that?
After the handling or...
After you approached the front of the church and the preacher knew that you were ready, how did he give you the snakes?
He gave the snake to me very gently. He laid it in my hands. I turned to face the congregation and lifted it up. And that's when, for me anyway, everything kind of disappeared. The preacher, the congregation, my friend, the photographer, had come with me that day. It all just faded to white. It was just me and this very large rattlesnake, and I felt as though I were disappearing too as I was lifting it up. And I couldn't hear anything, and everything just seemed to have faded into this whiteness. There came a point when suddenly it started coming back to me, and I realized that this loud shouting I was hearing was coming from my own mouth. And then suddenly all the music came back, and the sight of the congregation and the smell of the church, and I realized I was standing here with this enormous rattlesnake in my hands, and I could feel it. I could feel the muscles under its skin and the rough scales. And I decided that I needed to hand it back to the preacher, and I did.
Did you feel different after this experience was over? Different about yourself? Different about what you wanted from religion?
There are certain things that Christians believe, sort of as a matter of fact. I mean, it's just, it's rather mundane after a while, you know. God created the universe. God is watching over us and listening to our prayers and so forth. And we say it so often that it becomes kind of rote. It doesn't have any actual physical presence in our lives. During the process of being with the handlers and worshiping with them and listening to them, I came to understand that God is a spirit. It's something I've believed but have never really thought about. I don't think I ever really believed it. He's a spirit, and he's not a metaphor. I mean, he is real. He does exist, and he is capable of intervening in our lives. This is radical. It sounds so, so ordinary, because we say these things in church every Sunday. But if you consider the ramifications of this, it is extraordinarily radical.
I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to express this very clearly, but I found when I was reading your book both this just, you know, real sense of interest about the experience that you had and about your research into snake handling, but also just a little suspicious of a kind of, you know, middle class, educated journalist taking on the experience of snake handling. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to be able to express the suspicion that I felt, and I think it has to do with just the quest for adventure and, for the quest for adventure, the quest for an adrenaline high, the quest for a good yarn. It seems like the experience of snake handling would be so different from people who are kind of born into it and who aren't very educated and haven't been exposed much to the wider world and to the world of literature and metaphor and all of that. But you're, you know, a writer, a novelist, a journalist. You know what I mean? And I don't mean this in a, you know, I'm just trying to be honest about everything I was feeling as a reader. So, yeah. Can you talk to me about that a little bit?
Well, another thing you've got to understand is I'm a hillbilly. You know, I mean, it's in my genes. It's who I am. It's part of my place. And I didn't know that before, you know. The fact that I have a college degree and that I teach at a university, to me, is really irrelevant. It's a marvelous gift, that kind of formal education, but it's vastly overrated.
But hillbilly, you're talking about people, you know, who you researched in your family tree and everything, but hillbilly isn't a genetic thing. You know what I mean? It's a, so much of culture is a question of where you're from, what time you've, you know, the era that you've been living in. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know, but you see, I grew up in the 50s in a neighborhood that was striving for the middle class in Birmingham, Alabama. Didn't know who my people were. Uh-huh. And yet I would use expressions like Alswani, which is an expression that I didn't know at the time had been used 2 centuries before along the border between England and Scotland by border dwellers. You know, I mean, maybe it's not genetic, but it's certainly, I mean, we're carrying our past with us, you know, even when we don't know that we have such a past. One of the wonderful things about this, the experience of writing this book, has been discovering, you know, this history, this past that I'm carrying with me. And it's a past, by the way, that a lot of people don't want to talk about, you know, because I'm a white Southerner, you know. I mean, what right do I have to a past? I mean, look what my people have done. You know, that's the sort of general attitude. Well, you know, I have a right to my past. And simply because, you know, I've written for the New York Times or Vogue magazine or some, you know, Eastern establishment sorts of outlets, that I wasn't born to do that. You know, I'm the descendants of illiterate hill people. That's who I am. And I've had the benefits of a marvelous education, but more importantly, I've had the benefits of a moral education. And that's the kind of implement that I want to use now.
Do you find that your experiences are particularly difficult to talk about with Northerners or with people who aren't believers?
Well, I think that, I mean, and this is going to be a terrible generalization, but I'll make it anyway. I think that Northerners are inherently interested in the South. And I find that very refreshing and good and positive. It is difficult to talk to non-believers about Christianity. I mean, that's always a problem. But I don't know. You know, as I grow older, I seem to be peeling away layer after layer of my reticence to talk about such matters. I feel much more at ease now. And here I am talking to you, knowing that, you know, a lot of other people are going to be hearing this voice saying these things. And I just hope that I have the strength and the courage to stand behind the words that I'm saying to you.
Dennis Covington is the author of the new book Salvation on Sand Mountain, Snake Handling and Redemption in Southern Appalachia. He teaches creative writing at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Her acting is acclaimed. Her politics are controversial. Coming up, we talk with Vanessa Redgrave. She's written her autobiography. And book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Paperboy, a new novel by Pete Dexter, who also wrote Paris Trout. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Mexican stock market has rallied a bit from its plunge today. The market's main index had lost more than 11% of its value at one point today. It later recouped some of that loss, but it's still down more than 7%. Many traders say the giant loss is due to little confidence in the Mexican government projections about the economy and a steep rise in interest rates. In Southern California, 10 people have been rescued by helicopter, and several thousand more have been forced to evacuate their homes because of flooding along the Ventura River. Michael West of member station KCLU reports.
Other problems for residents include deep water on roadways and mudslides causing many streets to be closed. Sheriff's deputies and other emergency workers are out in force today answering calls of flooded businesses and homes. County Fire Chief Michael LaPlante says they are advising the public to use sandbags in an effort to protect their property, but local hardware stores are running low on supplies. Andy says officials are keeping a close watch on local waterways that are overflowing.
We're real concerned about the length of duration of the storm and the effect it's going to have on the major waterways here in the county. The Ventura River is already, I believe, out of its banks at the mouth.
A flash flood warning for Santa Barbara and Ventura counties remains in effect through tonight, with rain expected to continue for at least the next several days. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike West in Thousand Oaks, California.
The Federal Aviation Administration is welcoming back 26 air traffic controllers who were fired more than 13 years ago by President Reagan. The rehired controllers are reporting back to work today in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Kelly Burley of member station KOSU reports.
The returning air traffic controllers are among the more than 11,000 striking controllers who lost their jobs in 1981. They're the first to benefit from President Clinton's decision in May to lift the ban on rehiring fired controllers. The group will spend the next 5.5 weeks in training at the Mike Monroney Aeronautical Center in Oklahoma City. They will then be assigned to air traffic centers or control towers in New York, San Francisco, Honolulu, Oakland, and San Juan, Puerto Rico. If the first class of rehires checks out, the FAA may consider bringing back other fired controllers. More than 4,500 fired controllers are still eligible for a second chance with the agency, but FAA officials say major hiring increases are not planned until the late 1990s, when a wave of retirements is expected to begin. For National Public Radio, I'm Kelly Burley in Stillwater, Oklahoma.
California Governor Pete Wilson is calling for a 15% state tax cut. Wilson has delivered his annual State of the State address. He wants to reduce state taxes by 5% each year over the next 3 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average moved up today. The average gained more than 5 points to end at 3,866. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Senior officials representing the so-called Contact Group on Bosnia have decided today, after meeting in Paris, to tour the region immediately. They're trying to get the warring factions to the table. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
A French foreign ministry spokesman said the contact group would send envoys to Belgrade, Bosnia, and Zagreb without delay. He said the group wants to take advantage of the ceasefire to restart negotiations. The group reaffirmed its support for the peace plan, which would give 51% of Bosnia to a Muslim-Croat federation and the rest to the Bosnian Serbs. The Bosnian government has accepted the plan, which would preserve the territorial integrity of Bosnia. The Bosnian Serbs have rejected it, demanding changes in the map. The foreign ministry spokesman to the contact group aims to pressure the Serbs to agree to the plan as a basis for negotiations. Diplomats said the envoys would go to Belgrade on Wednesday and to Sarajevo on Thursday. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Florida authorities are still looking for five murderers who escaped from a state prison. Officials have set up a 60-agent task force to track the men down. Florida's governor has doubled the reward for their capture to $50,000. The inmates escaped from a prison in Belgrade on January 2nd. A spokesman says the men are probably armed by now and they're extremely dangerous. Although the search is the heaviest in South Florida, the FBI has alerted embassies in South and Central America and in the Caribbean. A Mississippi woman is filing a federal suit to stop prayers at her children's school. Lisa Herdahl has five children in public school. She says her kids are teased and harassed for not attending Bible class or participating in school prayer. The American Civil Liberties Union and the group People for the American Way have filed briefs supporting her case. A spokesman for the ACLU says the school is still transmitting morning prayers over the intercom system. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. British actress Vanessa Redgrave is now in New York, performing off-Broadway in a production of Vida and Virginia about the relationship between writers Virginia Woolf and Vida Sackville-West. Redgrave also has a new autobiography in which she discusses her acting career, her controversial politics, and her illustrious family. Her parents were the esteemed British actors Michael Redgrave and Rachel Kempson. Her sister is actress Lynn Redgrave. Her daughters are actresses Natasha and Jolie Richardson. Vanessa Redgrave's own movies include Howard's End, Prick Up Your Ears, The Bostonians, Playing for Time, Julia, The Devils, The Loves of Isadora, and Blow Up. But much of her career has been on the stage. Early in her career, in 1961, she was starring in a production of As You Like It. Just before the first performance, the director, Michael Elliott, took her aside and told her the whole production was going to fail because she wouldn't give herself up to the play. I asked Redgrave what the director was trying to get across.
Supposing I'm talking to you and you're talking to me, and if I fail to give you my full attention, then I am already failing to give myself up to you, as it were. If I fail to give you my full concentration, I fail to give myself up to you. The same will be the case in the theatre, but even more so, and even more importantly, if a part of the artist remains guarded, trying to control, rather fearful perhaps, but it's not necessarily connected with fear, although there is a connection. It's, if you cannot give yourself up to what you have worked with, the other actors, and the whole play that has emerged as a result of the communal work together, there will be something obscure in the performance, and since in the case of As You Like It, it is entirely about a human release after a human imprisonment, not entirely metaphorically speaking either, and a rejoice in that release. That is why my Rosalind, if I hadn't given myself up fully to Shakespeare's play, the production, the other actors and its significance, it would have been a disaster.
What did you do differently that first performance than you had done in rehearsals?
I can't say. I only know that I went onto that stage, and as I stepped onto it, I suppose it was rather like deciding, all right, I'll fall off this cliff because the sea's below, but I don't know what's going to happen now. All I know is the sea is below. The sea was the play, and I jumped off that cliff, and the sea was also the audience, and I let that play speak through me.
I'm thinking that there were two really big risks here. One, it was very risky for the director to drop this bomb right before a performance as opposed to during the middle of rehearsals. And it was very risky for you to try something new the night of the performance as opposed to in a rehearsal when you'd have more of a safety net, when you could decide, you know, I'm given too much here, I'd better draw back a little bit or tune it up a little bit before I actually do it in front of an audience.
Well, he had a very wise and thoughtful judgment, since he knew that if I didn't give up myself up to the play, it would definitely be disastrous for the whole production, for the play and for all the other actors. What could be lost? He had to go for the only thing that might make me release. And he did.
And that was what, a little bit of shock?
Well, it surprise, certainly was a shock pressure. Because I hadn't imagined him telling me that I was on the verge of making everybody have a disaster.
So is this your ambition? Did that become your ambition as an actress, to always just give your complete self and kind of jump off the cliff during a performance?
Well, I'd received some very important training by a wonderful singing teacher who was the coach at Glyndebourne until he died, called Yanni Strasser. I'd done a lot of work with him. And I've written about this in the book, and it's very important what he said. He said two things. First of all, singing is no different from speaking. You only sing because you are feeling and thinking so much that to speak it would be completely inadequate, an inadequate expression. You would not be able to communicate fully what you feel and think. So that was number one. And number two, he said, think of singing in this way, that your body and your mind, you can say, are a team of poodles. They're very well trained, you've worked hard, and they've worked hard. Now, if you keep them on a lead and try and force them to do what you want them to do, they will do it very well. But if you let them off the lead, they will do something that is beyond what they've been able to do at that point and beyond what you can do controlling them. And that something other is what is required. And that is true. As if you can read a great writer, Charlotte Bronte writing about her sister's writing, you can read Virginia Woolf in the Common Reader series, part one, at the end, when she speaks of that other objective existence of a writing, a life, a collection of lives, an event which exists outside the limitations of each individual who's working collectively together. And that collective produces something that surpasses all the summation of the individual limits of those who are working to produce it.
Vanessa Redgrave is my guest. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Vanessa Redgrave, and she's written her autobiography. American actresses seem to be really at risk as they get older because there's so few roles for older women in American films. And perhaps that's one of the reasons why so many American actresses have been getting plastic surgery lately. I think they feel their careers would be ruined without it. And I'm wondering if you think the pressures are different in England.
No, they're not different in England.
You strike me as someone who's not succumbing to that.
Well, I'm not. I did have, in 1985, I had a thing because I'd got really bad bags under my eyes. That was 10 years ago, and I had that done. And after that, I'd had a very hard time at that particular period.
What an emotionally hard
looking,
time.
And working very hard, too. And I really did look very, very, very old. So I had whatever they call, you know, to lift the bags under the eyes. And after that, I haven't had anything done. And I don't intend to. I wouldn't say to anyone else they shouldn't. But the pressures are simply enormous. I mean, how could you say I get my hair dyed for all sorts of roles? I get it dyed in life. Whether I would if I wasn't an actress, I have no idea. It's pointless to speculate. I am an actress. It would seem to me absurd with modern science to not want to cure whatever defects you actually have. But then, of course, there comes a line when perhaps what are actually your own individual attractivenesses are made out to be defects by colour magazines and by publicity and commercials, endlessly saying only if you're young.
Intellectually, you understand the meaning of looks and what they can give you and what they can't. You understand the meaning of aging. But emotionally, when you started looking at yourself in the mirror as you began to get wrinkles, as you got a little bit older, did it upset you or was it fine?
No, it didn't upset me in the least. But I earn my living by making films and the theatre. And so I'm in the same situation, or at that time certainly was, that I had to take a course of action that would mean that I could do some more work.
Have you been getting roles that you've been pleased with? Or do you feel that age has been an obstacle for you in your work?
I don't regard age as being an obstacle for me personally, because at this point I am not terrified. Because at this point I have made up my mind that I, you know, even if I couldn't work, and I certainly hope to continue working in theatre and film, but even if I couldn't, I'll take my lot with all those other people in their middle 50s.
You've taken on many political causes, and you've campaigned for Palestinian rights, and that has made you a subject of some controversy, at least here in the United States. I think perhaps you've lost some roles because of it. Do you think that your career as an actress has been affected by the political causes that you've taken on?
Yes, certainly it has.
Let me try to put into words what I think is a popular conception about you. I think a lot of people see you as politically ideological and unbending, but as an actress, very complex, insightful, and open. What would you say to that?
I wouldn't say anything to it at all. Partly because, you know, political people have their own axes to grind who write in newspapers, whatever that axe may be. And if they feel their careers are on their line or their jobs are on their line, they might say things that they felt would make their job more secure. But that has never concerned me. What has concerned me is what I think concerns most people, is to try to give the maximum support as I can as an artist and a human being, whether of a practical kind or an artistic and cultural kind or of a political kind, where people have no rights, whether they're young or elderly people in my own country or in any other country, and most especially where they have been robbed as a people of their rights. Therefore, I have made and contracted considerable attacks from fascists because of the work that I do against those fascists who are now working all over Europe, who are attacking Jews, Jewish synagogues, who are attacking Muslim homes. And I put in a lot of work there with other artists, because I think artists can do quite a lot in that respect, not just to raise money. I will therefore put myself behind all the attempts made by artists in Sarajevo and outside Sarajevo to prevent Sarajevo being divided and to prevent fascism winning the war, because that's what the war is about, which Milosevic and Karadzic are leading with support from outside. I look at those questions and I feel now I see the connection with New York City or London or Birmingham, UK, or Marseille or Rome or Milan. I see kids who haven't got a decent education because our governments haven't, and state authorities and municipal authorities haven't put the money where it should have gone. I see kids who haven't got jobs. I see people's lives being absolutely ruined. I see elderly people in conditions that are hardly any different from concentration camp conditions. And I see the New York Times full of very, very, very thorough, very good reporting on these questions. That reporting, I think, is a plus in our world. I see the media, on the one hand, playing a big role in investigating and reporting on such conditions. And that's, after all, I'm a person who works in the media.
You're currently performing in Vita and Virginia off Broadway. Tell us a little bit about the play.
Well, Vita and Virginia has been organically and extraordinarily drawn out by Eileen Atkins from the materials, that is to say, letters and diaries of Virginia Woolf, who is a Picasso-like genius of the English writing, much unappreciated in England, adored in America, which is where I'm happy to make a comparison, that everyone in America knows Virginia Woolf, studies Virginia Woolf. You can get Virginia Woolf out of the local public library in Queens. And the Philistinism in the United Kingdom is such that Virginia Woolf is paid lip service to. You'll find her photograph on the front of notepads that you get at a stationer's office or something. But the majority of people in schools don't know about her, don't read her, don't have the books to read. That is not the case here. Vita and Virginia is really about the love affair between Virginia Woolf and Vita Sackville-West. But it's, as all love affairs, it doesn't begin and end on date one and date two. It began when they met, and it ended only when Virginia committed suicide.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Vanessa Redgrave has written an autobiography. She performs off-Broadway in Vita and Virginia through March 19th. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the floods in California?
We have reporters out covering the story, Terry, and they will be calling us during the program tonight to talk about what the situation is like right at that moment. Also, we're looking at welfare reform, details of the president's plan and the Republican plan, a conversation with a couple of governors on block grants, and how welfare reform, block grants, and budget balancing amendments may all work together in the states. The peso is apparently in total meltdown, and we will have a report by David Wellner from Mexico City, and we'll be talking about budget reform.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Pete Dexter, who won a National Book Award for his novel Paris Trout, is also a veteran newspaperman. His new novel, The Paperboy, deals with a grim murder case and an investigative reporter whose obsession for the truth destroys his life. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
The narrator of Pete Dexter's novel, The Paperboy, is the son of a newspaper publisher and the younger brother of a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. But News Inc. doesn't run in Jack James's veins. In fact, he has nothing but contempt for the way most newspaper stories get written. Something moves, Jack says, and draws the eye, and that is as much as it takes. A day later, it is incorporated into the great, messy history of this place and time. Cautious human beings do not presume to write history on a day's notice. Jack's scorn makes sense once you know he's speaking as a dazed bystander who's watched an important newspaper story go haywire. By the mournful end of The Paperboy, the casualty count includes two deaths, a heinous miscarriage of justice, and the evaporation of Jack's vague dreams of happiness. The Paperboy takes place in 1969 in a remote corner of northern Florida. Jack, a varsity swimmer, has been expelled from the University of Florida for draining the swimming pool one night when he was in the throes of a psychic breakdown aggravated by vodka. He moves back home to work as a newspaper delivery truck driver for his father, a distant man who meets disappointment in silence. When his brother Ward arrives in town from Miami, the numbness of Jack's daily routine disappears. Ward is a famous investigative reporter who's hell-bent on reopening the case of a local man on death row for disemboweling a sheriff. Ward and a fellow journalist succeed in eventually freeing the convicted killer. Professional prizes and acclaim follow. Then Ward realizes he's been conned. not once, but twice. Though its central story is bleakly compelling, it's the descriptive and narrative detours the paperboy takes that really grace this novel with an awareness of life's capacity to surprise us with pain. One moment Jack is swimming peacefully far out in the ocean, the next he's under attack by a fleet of stinging jellyfish. Jack, Ward, and their father have snugly reunited when, almost overnight, the sons are locked out of the house. Towards the end of the novel, Ward is brutally beaten and rushed to the hospital. There, he's improperly anesthetized, so he hears the bones snapping in his face under the surgeon's scalpel. Our narrator, Jack, presents these scenes to us in a voice as flat as the Florida wetlands. And just like in newspaper accounts of catastrophes, his dispassionate tone adds to the shock. Dexter, like another great American storyteller, Richard Ford, seems drawn to the waste places in people's memories, and he knows how to convey their peculiar gray emptiness without draining his own writing of movement and color. With a novel this good, it's a pity to dwell on any flaws, but all the women characters here are straight from central shrew casting. One is so highly sexed, she attracts randy dogs. Another lures away Jack and Ward's dad. Still another ruins Ward's career. I'm not calling for equal opportunity characterization in all works of literature. All I'm wishing for here is that Dexter could have spent as much time fleshing out his women characters as he does different varieties of swamp life.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Paperboy by Pete Dexter. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, why affordable health care can't be left to the politicians or the physicians. We talk with Joseph Califano, former Secretary of Health Education and Welfare under Carter, now the founding president of the Center for Addiction and Substance Abuse. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.